People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And we're going to be talking about Baroque music, period instrument performance and so on, because my guest is Eric Dippenaar. And the second Cape Town Baroque Festival is yet again set to be a highlight on the city's music calendar, with local and international soloists and ensembles performing. The festival will offer audiences a varied program of top-quality Baroque music, and it runs from Friday, the 21st of September, to Sunday, the 23rd, a weekend of glorious Baroque music. And over the weekend, the Camerata Tinta Barocca will present 8 events. And for the first time, the festival also collaborates with the popular Cape Town Concert Series in a program of Baroque chamber music. Now, my guest, as I said, is Eric Dippenaar, who is in fact the festival director. And apart from that, Eric is currently artistic director of the Cape Town-based Baroque Orchestra Camerata Tinta Barocca. He's a part-time lecturer in Western music history and historical performance at the University of Cape Town. And at the moment, he's studying towards a PhD in music at UCT, focusing on the role of historical domestic keyboard instruments that they played in the colonization process in South Africa. So, Eric, a warm welcome to People of Note.
Thank you very much, Rodney.
You're one of those guests that's been long overdue to get you in and talk about period instruments, and I think I've only ever had one guest talking about that, and that was Andrew Cruikshank.
Oh, yes, colleague, harpsichord colleague.
That's right.
There aren't many of us around, so...
No, especially if someone like you and he, who happen to be so interested in performance practice and not just playing the harpsichord. Mm-hmm. I'm sure many people can play the harpsichord, but when we're talking to someone like you, it is infused with a huge amount of historical data in your head that you've accumulated over the years. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think for me, the thing about historical performance is that it's much wider than just early music. I just this morning taught a class at UCT about performance practice, and it's about thinking about music and the things we do, thinking about what's on the page, and what do we do that's not written down on the page. And of course, when you deal with historical music especially, you have to think very carefully about the choices you make in terms of various kinds of performance practices. For me, it's a way at looking at music as a whole, and also looking at music in context in society, the role of music, the reason why we make it, and why it was made or written.
Gosh, that sounds fascinating right at the beginning. But am I right in saying that it was in the late 50s, early 60s, that the so-called period instrument movement began with people like Nicholas Arnoncourt, and suddenly we started hearing Bach passions and works and Beethoven symphonies played on period instruments?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, the first people to really explore historical instruments was Arnold Dolmetsch in England, the end of the 19th century,
the
beginning of
player,
the...
Yeah.
Exactly. He's the one who made the first modern reconstruction of a recorder. And also Wanda Landowska, the harpsichordist in France, who had the piano company make a harpsichord. But it's really post-World War II, so from the 50s with Arnoncourt and Gustav Leonhardt, that we see that this historical performance movement, or early music as it was called then, became increasingly part of the mainstream. And it's interesting that through the course of the second half of the 20th century, there's already been quite a development in period style. So if you listen to a recording from the early 70s on period instruments, it does sound radically different from a recording, say, from the late 90s or early 2000s. Yeah. Because period style has also gone through an evolution, and like any performance practice, it doesn't stay constant and stable, it evolves.
I'll tell you what a wonderful illustration of that is the early first recording Roger Norrington made,
yes,
of the Beethoven symphonies of the London Classical Players in the 90s, I think. And then he redid it only a few years ago with the Stuttgart Orchestra. And even there, the same conductor and using the same sort of approach, there are remarkable differences between the two.
Absolutely, and we saw it recently with John Elliott Gardner's re-recording of the Mass in B minor 2. His first one was made in 1985, and he recently re-recorded it, and it does sound much different, actually.
Eric, the situation in South Africa has not been that vast, has it? I mean, there are very few chances we get in this country to go and listen to a properly informed Peer-Dinsmond historic performance.
Yes, that's true, but we are making a difference and things are changing. So part of our work with Tinta Barocca I'm very proud of, because I'm very proud of the fact that we now in Cape Town have a steady period orchestra, and sometimes we play in ensemble format as well. And I think the festival that you referred to earlier is also part of that, because for many years practitioners of historical performance in South Africa throughout the country has been working quite in isolation. And one of the reasons behind the festival is that with last year's festival and this one as well, we want to bring together practitioners so that not only, of course, it's a wonderful occasion to bring people together, but for us to share ideas with colleagues. And I think that's very, very necessary in any kind of art form, but especially in music. And then also, of course, the international guests that we have, that it's a process of sharing ideas and so it's good for audiences, but it's also equally good for us.
Stimulating,
I think.
For
yes,
you.
Yes, absolutely.
As well, there's so much I want to find out also about the festival, but just also about period instruments and what they've meant to you and how you've got involved in this and how it's really dominating your life. So I'm intrigued by your choice of music and what we're going to hear, and you have to tell us why and what it's all about.
So the first choice is by Bach, and it comes from the Mass in B minor. It's the Et in Unum Dominum from the Credo. And this piece of music is especially something that's very close to my heart. And it's because when I was 17, I, of course, at that stage, never heard about period performance. My music teacher at the time in the town that I grew up sadly passed away from cancer. And then her husband asked me to clear out her teaching room. So I had to sort out the books and CDs. And I spent 2 days doing that. And in the process, I discovered the CD of arias and choruses from the two Bach Passions and Mass in B minor and the Christmas Oratorio. And I put it on, and I think at that point my life changed. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Everything from the way to the string instruments, spirit string instruments sounded, the baroque oboes, the way the singer sang, it was like a universe that opened up to me. And I think I listened to that CD 2 or 3 times a day for the next year. So the first track comes from that CD, and the singers are Patricia Queller and Mary Nichols. And this comes from the John Elliott Gardner recording of 1985.
Oh,
an excerpt there from Bach's Mass in B minor, Et in Unum Dominum, and the first choice of my guest, Eric Dippenaar. And we're talking about period instruments and period performance, and that was John Elliott Gardiner's recording of Bach's Mass in B minor, the first of the two he did. Eric, we're also talking about the Baroque Festival. That's why Eric is here, because the Cape Town Baroque Festival 2018 opens on Friday the 21st of September and runs through that weekend, a whole weekend of glorious period instrument movement. And Eric, you were talking about Camerata Tinta Barocca, of which you are now conductor. Are there instruments by any chance period instruments? Because sometimes the instruments themselves are period instruments as such, in the way they, or are they just strung in a certain way, or how do they get the sound?
That's a very interesting question. Generally, when we refer to period instruments, it means either period instruments of the period, so, or copies of instruments from the period. With string instruments, it's interesting because most, say, we're talking about violins, most Baroque violins were altered during the 19th century, early 20th century, to a modern setup. So the angle of the neck was changed and various things, the length of the bass bar. So even if you play on a real Baroque violin, a violin from, say, 1720, it's not really considered a period instrument unless the setup is changed back to how it would have been originally. So in Camerata Tinta Barocca, we have a combination of original instruments or copies of original instruments. With wind instruments, it's more difficult because the wood, because of the humidity of playing it, does tend to give an instrument a lifetime. So I know researchers who does research into historical wooden instruments, it's difficult because the best instruments are very in museums are very often in an unplayable condition because the best instruments would have been played a lot. And the instruments that are still playable in collections are not necessarily the best instruments because they were not very good instruments. So with wood instruments, it's very often, in most cases, we use copies of original instruments. Okay. With string instruments, their lifetime is much longer, and in fact, they do get better with age. With keyboard instruments, mostly copies too, simply because there aren't so many original keyboard instruments left.
I was going to say, do we have a forte piano, a good forte piano in Cape Town?
We don't. We have several square pianos, which was the domestic version of the piano, a pre-upright piano. And there are a few mid-19th century straight-strung pianos left in Cape Town. And I'd love to see one of those restored and that one can use that for Schubert, Schumann, that type of repertoire. And there's a massive difference, of course, between straight-strung pianos and cross-strung pianos. But I'd love to, at some stage, if we can get a copy of a late 18th century piano, the type of piano that Mozart and Haydn would have known, because that is it's a completely different sound world to a modern piano.
And you hear them on those recordings
Absolutely.
With people like Stephen Lubin, the period instrument recordings of Mozart piano concertos or Bach keyboard concertos.
Yes.
Just to make it simple, talking about Camerata Tinta Barocca, so man in the street sort of stuff for the moment, Eric. You tune down slightly, don't you? You don't tune up to, say, what the Cape Philharmonic would tune to, because the period instruments as well are not as, well, they're not strong enough, really, to be pulled like
That's a very interesting point, Rodney. So pitch is one of the essential elements of historical performance, and we know that throughout the history, there were many different pitches at different times. So even if you look at the beginning of the 18th century, in Rome, the pitch was very low, about a whole tone lower than modern concert pitch. And in Venice, at the same time, the pitch was almost a semitone higher than modern concert pitch. So, and 18th century writers wrote about this a lot. Quantz, in his well-known treatise, says it's a problem if you travel, even from town to town, because the pitch is slightly different. And you find, for instance, 18th century original flutes with several middle joints so that you can adjust to different pitches. And Quantz pleads, he makes a case for having a universal pitch. So the idea that there should be one pitch has been around for very long. Of course, it wasn't officially until 1939. In London, there was a conference that they decided that the pitch will be 440. So, yes, generally, historical pitches can be higher or lower, but for practical reasons, 415, which is a semitone lower than modern concert pitch, is a kind of general historical performance pitch for Baroque music, simply because you really need a different instrument for every pitch. So financially, it's not a very viable situation to have about four or five or six different instruments for every. So the kind of what we mostly play is early 18th century music, and generally for that 415, the semitone lower than modern concert pitch, is a kind of consensus pitch that
right,
we use.
Okay, and then presumably the string players are not using vibrato.
Very sparing vibrato, also. So not continuous vibrato like modern players would, and the instruments are strung up in uncovered guts, so pure gut strings. The bows are much lighter and of a different shape, so there's a substantial difference between a down bow and an up bow, so you have definite strong beats. And especially in French music, that was very, very necessary because the French love dance, and it really comes from the dance that there's a clear downbeat to the beginning of every bar, and as we talk about a beat hierarchy, so there are certain beats that's more important than others,
yeah.
And you do that by usage of the bow. Of course, and I always use the example, it's like any type of tool. You can, if you have the appropriate tool for a job, it makes the job much easier. And with instruments, it's exactly the same thing. If you play, say, a late 17th century French dance on an instrument with a bow from the period, it's much easier to get the type of nuance that the dance asks for when you do it with the original bow.
Gosh. And we'll be able to witness all this at the Baroque Festival and possibly even ask questions.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think with the festival, the idea is that all of the concerts are presented on period instruments, and we try to present a range of repertoire. So it goes up from early 17th century repertoire to even Mozart, so end of the 18th century. And also to show, I think, that when we talk about Baroque, of course, the word Baroque is something that was coined in retrospect, and originally it wasn't a very positive term, the association with a misshaped pearl, but that within the Baroque, it's difficult to group the whole period together because
yes.
There are so many streams, and even at the same time you'd find so many different aesthetic views varying from country to country.
I think let's have another piece of music, Eric, while we absorb all that.
So next up is an early 17th century two pieces, and this comes from a CD by the Italian group Il Giardino Armonico, and they are an Italian early music group. And when I went and studied at the Royal College of Music and I could finally specialize in early music, this was one of the first groups that I really discovered, and I still think their recording of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, it was groundbreaking. I once you've heard that, you can't unhear it, and it's, I must say it's difficult listening to any other recordings. But this is not a recording of the Four Seasons. It's a disc of early 17th century music, and what they did on the disc is they grouped different pieces by different composers together. And I think that's something that I really like about pre-19th century music, the fact that the idea of authorship, the idea of intellectual property, copyright, of course, was completely different from today. So on the CD, they kind of group different pieces together, and almost the whole disc flows into one hour-long piece of early 17th century music by different composers. So we're going to listen to the first two tracks, and the first track is by Monteverdi. It's the Symphonia from the Return of Ulysses to his Homeland, and then it flows into a piece by Merula, which is a Chaconne early 17th century dance with a repeated bass line.
Thank you.
We've just heard two pieces there, the first by Monteverdi, the second by Merula. What were they exactly, Eric?
It was, the Monteverdi piece was a sinfonia from the return of Ulysses to his homeland. And then by Merula we heard a sciaccona, which is an early 17th century Italian dance.
Played by that group.
Il Giardino Armonica, yes, the Italian early music group.
We've got a few CDs there, here, gosh, they're good. My guest is Eric Dipinara. And in fact, we're talking about paired instruments and baroque instruments because there's the upcoming Cape Town Baroque Festival, which runs from the Friday the 21st to Sunday the 23rd of September at various venues in Cape Town. More information later. But just before we get back to the festival and baroque music and pitches and strings and bowings, Eric, you mentioned that you heard that piece of music, the Bach, that changed your whole outlook on music. Had you been studying music before that? Was music always part of your life?
Yes, I think from when I can remember, I loved music and I always knew I wanted to do that as a career. In fact, I recently bumped into my old primary school sub A teacher, and she told me apparently that I told her when I was 7 years old that I'm going to play the piano for a living. well, that didn't quite turn out to the piano, but still, when I can recall, I wanted to do music. And as I said earlier, when I was 17, I heard the first period recording, which really changed the way I listened to music. I then went on and I did an undergrad at Stellenbosch University, where I did organ performance, was my principal study, and a bit of harpsichord on the side. And after that, I went off to London to study the organ at the Royal College of Music. Now, when I came there for a master's degree, it wasn't 2 weeks. And that was the first time, of course, I was at an institution which had a proper early music or historical performance department. And it wasn't 2 weeks of me being there that I went and I saw the head of postgraduate studies and I asked if I can swap around to early music as my principal study, which they then allowed me to do. And I'm very thankful for the organ department of the Royal College because I had an organ scholarship and still they let me switch around to harpsichord as principal study. And it's interesting because years later I had a lesson with Trevor Pinnock, the very well-known harpsichordist, and he told me that he in the late 60s studied at the Royal College and the same thing happened to him. He went to study the organ and he wanted to switch over to harpsichord and the then director told him no, he can't because the harpsichord isn't a real instrument. So some things do change for the better.
And tell me a little bit about your harpsichord. So okay, you changed direction, harpsichord was now your instrument. They must be quite difficult to come by, proper harpsichords, not sort of fake harpsichords. So I'm interested to know about your instrument and where you got it in Harlem.
Yes, Rodney, that's an interesting point. The thing is with harpsichords, there is no standardized version or model of it. So harpsichord building in Italy is especially something that I really like. I like the sound ideal of Italian instruments. So the main instruments that I use is a copy of an early 18th century Italian instrument, very long, and it's a very light construction with relatively light stringing, which makes the instrument very resonant. So that's the instrument I use most and that I prefer.
But you take it around with you then?
I take it around whenever I can. Of course, one has to, because the construction is so light, you can't take it inland in winter because of the dryness. So humidity is something that really can do harm to an instrument. But of course, when I play different types of repertoire, one has to use an instrument that's most suitable to the repertoire. So I have a copy of a late 18th century English spinet as well, which I use for especially French music or English music. And there are some copies of French and Flemish instruments around in Cape Town. And one has to choose an instrument which is most suited to the repertoire you're doing. I mean, in an ideal world, I'd own, I think, 15 different instruments so that I can use exactly the right instrument for the right type of repertoire. But again, it's just in impracticality.
How many do you have at the moment?
At the moment, I have 4 instruments. So I have a long Italian harpsichord. I have Italian virginals. And I have English copy of late 18th century English spinet, and I have a chamber organ which I also use. And then I was just very kindly given a half completed clavichord, which is sitting in my bedroom, and post PhD I'll make work of that.
Yes, I want to ask you about your PhD. I wonder if I should do that now since you mentioned, because I'm most intrigued by the title. It says here that you're doing a PhD focusing on the role historical domestic keyboard instruments played in the colonization process in southern Africa.
That's a mouthful.
Yes. What does that mean?
So I, when I started looking at possibility of doing a PhD, I thought I wanted to do it about a South African topic and something that's close to my heart. So historical keyboard instruments and something South African. So it was an obvious combination for me. And when I started looking into most history writing that has been done about Western classical music in South Africa. Of course, we deal with long colonial history. Unfortunately, I found that much of the history writing that has been done was done from a very specific political viewpoint. So the idea that I think especially in the 70s and 80s, especially at Afrikaans universities, they tried to push the agenda that to show that there was a self-sufficient Western classical European music tradition in South Africa. So much of the research that was done, I found, was done from that viewpoint, and it doesn't necessarily give, I think, a good overview of what happened here. So I had to go back to all the original sources and find references to keyboard instruments in various types of sources. And then finally, my last chapter will be about the role that these instruments played in the colonization process. So I work with the keyboard instrument, which is a piece of furniture. It's difficult to move. It's difficult to maintain. It's not like a violin or clarinet that you can pick up easily. So I work with the cultural symbolism of this piece of furniture, a keyboard instrument. One of the writers kind of coined it, said that a keyboard instrument fulfills a totemic function, so like a totem pole. So I work with all the cultural meanings of this instrument within the colonial context. I think with keyboard instruments, it's even more interesting because very often keyboard instruments at home was associated with part of the education of women in European society. So they, of course, had to embroider and paint and do certain things, but nothing quite too well. So also we work with a type of soft colonialism. So the idea that this wasn't a strong political statement, but in the kind of domestic environment that symbolized something, and it said something about society.
What a fascinating subject. I hope it's going to be available for everyone to read, or is it going to be terribly academic?
At the moment, I'm just hoping to finish it, to be honest.
Okay. Eric, I think it's time for another piece of music.
So next up, we have a piece by Adelina Patti, sung by Adelina Patti. She was one of the most well-known 19th century singers, and apparently Verdi said in 1877, he said she was perhaps the finest singer who's alive today. And she was, of course, sang in the bel canto style. And in the beginning of the 20th century, some recordings were made of her at her home in Wales, and she was just over 60. And here she sings Mozart aria, Voice Sapete.
But now this is a 1905 recording, I see. Are we going to be able to hear anything?
I hope so. I think it's for me, these early recordings are very interesting because, of course, we deal with music pre-recording technology, and the historical performance movement has crept up to us through 19th century music, even to early 20th century music. So it's interesting to listen to an actual recording from a time that we now have modern period recordings.
This is going to be fascinating. Let's go. Goodness, I don't quite know what to say. What an extraordinary sound and style in everything. That's all the way from 1905.
And I think although she was just over 60 when she recorded it, I think there's a lot to be learned from the actual 19th century way of singing bel canto.
Okay. Adelina Patti. Yes. And you said Verdi had also heard her and liked her very much.
Yes, she was one of his favorite singers, and she was one of the main singers at Covent Garden for very long.
It's amazing what has been recorded, actually, all those times ago. So thank you. That was, as I said, I'm not quite sure what to say, but certainly an experience. I'm talking to Eric Dippenaar about the Baroque Festival and about Baroque music and Baroque performance in general here on People of Note on Fine Music Radio. And I just want to continue a little bit while you're here, from the horse's mouth, so to speak. When you are rehearsing with a group like Tinta Barocca, who are committed to performing period instrument style, I believe it's quite difficult to play on a stringed instrument, certainly without vibrato, a friend of mine was saying, you can't hide anything. Your intonation has to be absolutely spot on.
Absolutely, that's very true. I always say when you learn a period equivalent of your instrument, it's in a way like learning a new instrument.
You have
to play the instrument, learn to play it in a new way. Very often you actually hold the instrument in a completely different way. So with cellos, you don't have a spike. With violins, you don't have all the scaffolding kind of holding the instrument up. So you have to learn a new technique. And I think it's not just as easy as picking up a period instrument and playing it. It's even with keyboard instruments, your touch has to be very different, and you have to learn to use your body in a different way from playing the modern piano or organ. But having said all of that, I think I have to also stress that what we're trying to present is not a musical museum. I think, as I said, it's about using the appropriate tools for the job, but we present concerts of music, and the reason I think why we make music is to move people. So if we're not presenting a museum that's of interest to people to look at as a novelty, I think the result should always be, when you do a concert, that it should move people emotionally and transport them somewhere.
Look, it's an interesting debate that on its own, because there are those people who say, you know, the famous old story, if Mozart were alive today, he'd be using a Steinway, which is obvious, but also to move people in the way that Mozart might have heard the music is actually what period instrument performance is all about.
Absolutely.
It's stylistically correct. There's nothing wrong, I'm sure you agree, with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields playing a Mozart symphony, but you hear something different if you hear Johnny at Gardner.
Absolutely. I think for us, it's learning from the instruments. So understanding the music better through the original instruments. But I'm not one that says the only way to play it is on period instruments. I think there are many other colors that modern instruments do offer, and that it's wonderful to explore that. So in a way, I'm not a purist, I suppose.
I annoy some of my period instrument friends by saying how much I enjoy, for example, Klemperer's Beethoven.
Yes.
Because although it is that mid-20th century big granite-like sound, his articulation that he gets, the bowings that he uses, and the clarity he gets, even at fairly slow tempi, I don't know if you've ever heard his recording of Messiah, which is an extraordinary experience and probably horrifies you. But I bet you there's something about it that you find interesting.
Absolutely. And I think that comes back to the distinction between early music and performance practice, because that is a type of performance practice. And of course, in 100 years' time, we'll look at that as some kind of historical. And that is the thing. I think, like anything, like our clothes, musical performance moves in fashion, taste and style, and that it moves quite quickly, actually. We have references from the 18th century where they talk about old-fashioned music, and then it's music from 20 years before. So it's pretty much like pop music today. And that's just the way music works, and it's a wonderful thing because it's alive and it changes, and it's exciting to follow.
But isn't it interesting that, okay, so the first part of the 20th century, Wagner had a big influence, didn't he, on making things sound big, changing, messing around with the score, actually.
Yes, yes.
And this huge, bigger and bigger and bigger sound was created. And then it started thinning out with encore and things. But what I find so interesting now is that the Berlin Philharmonic to a Beethoven cycle under Sir Simon Rattle. But it was period instrument informed.
Yes.
In other words, it was the modern orchestra, but he was asking them to bow and articulate in a period instrument style, which makes a world of difference on a modern symphony orchestra. Do you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we see that Roger Norrington also did some recordings of with modern orchestras, but in period instrument style. And I think, in my opinion, even if you're a kind of modern symphonic instrumentalist, as part of your education, it's a good thing to just tackle a period instrument for a bit, because one does learn some things from the instrument. But I think I've heard some of the Berlin Philharmonic recordings, and they're really good, and it's nice to listen to.
So it has its effect. I once annoyed a period instrument friend of mine, Rosemary Lalden, who runs that group Busgate, which sounds so amazing.
Wonderful, wonderful
those
ensemble.
Young children
playing,
all playing with no vibrato, and that open string sound was lovely. I said on the air once, when I played a period instrument piece, that it's like those are the vegetarians. And she got
the
very
sandal
cross.
Wearers. That's the cliche.
Yes.
But I must say, Rosemary's doing wonderful work, and I haven't heard I worked with him once or twice, and that group, they play especially French music, Rameau, so stylishly. It's really wonderful.
Yes, to hear them playing Rameau, Jean-Philippe Rameau.
Yes, yes.
We could go on forever, Eric, but anyway, what is your next piece of music?
So my next piece of music is a piece of organ music, because the organ was really my starting point, and I'm still very fond of the organ as instrument. I'm also very fond of late 18th century English music. So this is a concerto, organ concerto by James Hook. It's the last movement, it's in rondo form, and the organist is Stephen Farr. And although it's called a concerto, it's really, I suppose, a chamber concerto. It's just for two violins and cello and a written out solo organ part. So it's James Hook, his organ concerto number 5 in D major, the last movement.
And while we listen to this, the organ that's being used, is it what you might call, because I mean, there's another whole program to talk about styles of organs.
Yes.
What is he using in this one?
This is an original mid 18th century English organ.
Thank you. organ concerto there by James Hook, an English composer. His organ concerto number 5, the last movement, and another choice of my guest, Eric Dipenaar. We've been having a fascinating conversation about period performance. Eric, as you know, is the harpsichordist and also leader of Camerata Tinta Barocca. And the Cape Town Baroque Festival this year is about to open on the 21st, Friday the 21st of September, to Sunday the 23rd. And although we've sort of discovered what it's about, but I'd just like, how did it come into being? Last year was the first one, wasn't it, Eric?
Yes, Rodney. We had the first festival last year. And as I said earlier, the idea was to bring practitioners of early music from across South Africa together. And this year, we also have two international guests. We're bringing Karen van Heerden, ex-South African, currently Austrian baroque oboist and recorder player, and also an Austrian natural trumpeter to play in the Vivaldi Gloria in the opening concert.
Because there's another conversation about the brass instruments.
Absolutely.
And the natural trumpet before it had the keys.
Yes, yes.
When Haydn wrote his concerto, but pre that. But these concerts, therefore, will be of particular interest. And I'm just looking through your program. There are all sorts of different styles as well. But will people be able to come up and look at the instruments or talk to you?
Absolutely. I always encourage audience members to... It's concerts, so it's not lectures. So we don't, in the concert, give much information about the instruments. But people are absolutely welcome to come to us, have a look at the instruments, ask us about it and discuss it. And I always encourage the players also to hang around, sometimes even in the interval, over a glass of wine, which we're not allowed to have, of course, in the interval, to come and talk to us and ask questions about the instruments.
And have you found, was last year's success, would you say it was a success?
Absolutely. We kind of, out of the dark, made last year's festival, and we saw it as a type of an experiment, but it went off very well, and we are very lucky with audiences in Cape Town, very supportive audiences. So, and then that, of course, encouraged us to present the second installment, and
hopefully
that will be in part of our annual calendar.
Because it's unique, isn't it, to South Africa, this festival, as far as I know?
Yes, apart from Richard Cox's Baroque in the Bush up in the Kruger Park, Cape Town is slightly more accessible, I think.
Okay, well, let's just see now. There's a website address here, which I'd just like to give people quickly. If you want to find out anything or book or whatever, www.ctbaroque.co.za/festival.
Yes, so that will take you to the Camerata Tinta Barocca website, and there's a separate festival page on which you can find all the details of the concerts and booking details.
And there are various venues, aren't there, because you're also performing at the concert series.
So originally the idea was to have all the concerts in historical venues in the city centre, but this year we have this wonderful collaboration with the Cape Town Concert Series. And that concert will be in the Baxter Concert Hall on the Saturday night.
Okay. And John Rennie is going to be presenting a walking tour as well as part of this.
He'll do a tour of the Heading campus. Last year he did a tour of some historical churches in the city centre, but this year he's tackling the Heading campus, which is of course a cluster of historical buildings from different periods quite close to each other.
So, gosh, it's going to be a fascinating weekend. Put on your Baroque shoes and get there. So, Eric, thank you very much for the chat, and thank you for enlightening us so much on this amazing business of period instruments. And I'm certainly going to be looking forward to hearing what this all sounds like in those various venues. So what are you going to leave us with?
The last piece comes from Mexico, Baroque music composed in Mexico, and it was recorded by Andrew Lawrence King and his harp consort, and it's a guaracha, which is a dance, Afro-Cuban style dance, and in it the text just says that let's bring all the bands together and singers and make music to celebrate the birth of the baby Jesus.
Eric Dipenaar, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rodney.
Oh.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This December, something extraordinary is coming to Cape Town. Experience the global phenomenon Matilda the Musical, inspired by the magic of Roald Dahl, live on stage at Artscape. The New York Post says, believe the hype. Don't miss the musical of the decade, proudly brought to you by Peter Turin and GWB Entertainment in association with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Be a genius. Book now.